Welcome to another spotlight episode of Oncology for the Inquisitive Mind, featuring none other than your hosts, Michael. Hey, Michael.
Hello, Josh.
And Josh. Amazing. So today we have a really interesting spotlight episode. There is an article that has recently been published by Albert Grinspoon. I butchered that name, but Sarah Tulaney, Harold Burstein, Erica Mayer, Renath Jessel John. This is the group of oncologists that essentially talking about the dilemma of selecting a first line CDK4/6 inhibitor for the hormone receptor positive HER2 negative cohort of metastatic breast cancers. Going back to 2015 as a historical context, palbociclib was the kingpin, but we'll get into details. Paloma-2 had some interesting results. Then came along ribociclib and abemaciclib. And since then, there has been this ongoing joust between oncologists, between researchers, between clinicians about which is the golden child. What do you do to treat your breast cancer patients in the first line setting?
Absolutely. It is a tale as old as the universe itself. Which drug is best? And Josh, you sort of summarized it very well.
The article,
yeah, pretty much. But the prevailing wisdom has really been, if we account for the differences in the various phase three studies that examine these CDKs, they are pretty much interchangeable. And I've had multiple oncologists, I'm sure you have too, Josh, that say, look, I just use whatever is appropriate for the patient, whatever I'm most comfortable with, because the data is fairly similar across the board. But is that actually the case?
Okay, and we're not so sure. So overall, these drugs are the backbone of contemporary therapy. You know, they revolutionized metastatic hormone receptor positive breast cancer in the first line. They all inhibit CDK4 and 6. And they all have oral bioavailability, but there are some differences with respect to the chemical, biological, and pharmacological features.
And we'll go through all of these a little bit later, but to set the scene, Josh, why don't we summarize the data? Because a lot of people, as we said, say that the agents are interchangeable, the data is very similar. But before I actually read up on this topic and there's a fantastic table in the article that we'll put in the description, I didn't actually realize how similar the raw numbers were across the pivotal trials in this space.
Yeah, fair enough. I think the main trials we should look at today is probably Paloma-2, which is palbociclib in the first-line hormone receptor-positive metastatic setting, Mona-Lisa-2, which is ribociclib, and then you've got Monarch-3, which is abemaciclib.
So notably, we won't really be talking about Mona-Lisa-3, which instead of a non-steroidal anti-androgen that is available in the oral form, such as letrozole, it used fulvestrant in the first-line setting, or Mona-Lisa-7, which also included patients who were on gasserolin plus tamoxifen or a non-steroidal aromatase inhibitor, just for ease of comparison.
I think that's it. And if we're going to summarize it and not make this too dry, the number of patients within each of the cohorts was similar. The amount of follow-up was best in Paloma-2 in 90 months.
Which makes sense because it's the oldest trial.
That is correct, Michael. You were astute in saying that. 80 months for Mona-Lisa-2 and Monarch-3 is 70.2 months. So close, but not there, Justin.
A virtual baby by comparison.
Yeah, it's not a baby boomer. It's just a baby.
Moving on to the median PFS, and this is, again, we're only talking about the combination arms, worth noting that here. But in Paloma-2, the median PFS was 24.8 months. In Mona-Lisa-2, 25.3 months. And Monarch-3, 28.2 months. So sure, there are some numerical differences, but if we sort of zoom out to a more macro setting for three independent trials of three similar but different drugs, incredibly similar results.
And different trial designs. I think that's something we have to kind of talk about there. There are different trials designs, so this is a dirty comparison. Mm. I appreciate that. But the numbers, the raw numbers, are important to discuss in this context. And if you look at the median overall survival, which is the next thing, and this is where it gets really interesting. Paloma 2, palbociclib, had an overall survival of 53.9 months. Move across to Mona Lisa 2, which is ribociclib. You add 10 months to that, which is 63.9 months. And then if you go to Monarch 3, it was 67.1 months, ousting both the other two. But interestingly, I don't believe, is the five-year data out for Monarch 3, Michael?
I don't think so.
Yeah, so that was an interim from memory.
Yeah, I think that there are 2 or 3 year interim overall survival data. Of note, and, you know, we've been talking about the combination arm up to this point, but to show you how similar these agents are, look at the control arm. Even accounting for differences in study design, in patient population, virtually identical. So with Paloma 2 in the control arm, the median overall survival was 51.2 months. In Mona Lisa 2, 51.4 months. And in Monarch 3, 54.5 months. So there were some concerns about, oh, with Paloma 2, when the overall survival data first came out, I remember there was a little bit of discourse that said the patients who got AI did better than expected. Mm-hmm. And that might have skewed the hazard ratios. But the burden of evidence is starting to shift that AIs are just that good, because all of these studies, letrozole was predominantly used in Monarch 3. I think they allowed anastrozole, but they're interchangeable, I reckon. So the quality of AI as a sole treatment for metastatic breast cancer is fantastic. Mm-hmm. And so that is something else, again, this entire episode is going to be us basically covering ourselves by saying, whatever you do, don't do what we're doing. But if you look at the numbers, they are the similarities are uncanny.
That's it. And the one thing I didn't mention is that the issue, although all amazing results, is Paloma 2 was not statistically significant for a combination overall survival, whereas Mona Lisa 2 has been, and Monarch 3 interim analysis did not meet their threshold.
Yes, and worth noting as well that with Paloma 2, there was a final overall survival analysis.
Final.
Yes, you know, lock it in, absolutely no take-backsies here. But there was a final overall survival analysis that was recently published, I think, in January of this year. And the reason that this is the final study was that in the original final overall survival analysis, there were a number of patients that were lost to follow-up. And so mortality data was not available. With this super-duper no-take-backsies final overall survival, they did their utmost to follow up these patients who had been lost to follow-up, because there were more patients lost to follow-up in the combination arm compared to the control arm. But even accounting for those lost data, the overall survival benefit remains not statistically significant. But Josh, before you mentioned that even though we sort of clump these drugs together.
Clumpity clump,
indeed. There are important pharmacokinetic and pharmacodynamic differences between them. So do you want to talk a bit more about that?
Yeah, I think so. The first thing to mention, palbo and ribociclib are also given as an intermittent fashion. They both have really highly selective CDK4 and CDK6, but ribo has a higher inhibition ratio of 4, given its weaker potency for the inhibition of just CDK6.
And from what I was able to read, CDK4 is probably the one that you want to inhibit if you are going to be selective.
And whereas abemaciclib is slightly different with its structure. So there, that inhibition ratio is 5, with an addition activity of other kinases. So the agent exhibits different acquired drug and mechanisms of resistance, right? So this is also something that comes into the preclinical models, which shows that just because of their slight different CDK inhibitions, they're going to have slightly different ways of having intrinsic resistance and thus overall survival and progression-free survival data.
It's also worth noting that abemaciclib is, as far as we can tell, as far as we could find in the literature, the only one of the three CDKs that has a significant penetrance of the blood-brain barrier, which, given that we're talking about advanced disease, is very clinically significant.
It's also given twice a day.
Yeah, so you have a higher pill burden. There's no break.
Mm-hmm.
It is given in a continuous fashion, which I guess is the first hint that these drugs are not the same.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And another interesting thing, if we move a little bit on and maybe look at the adjuvant setting, would that be okay?
Yeah.
I have permission.
We can take a bit of a detour into the adjuvant.
Yeah. So they tried to do this with palbociclib through the PALLAS and the Penelope B trial. And interestingly, did not show significance in overall survival versus just adjuvant endocrine therapy alone. So if you look at the NATALEE trial, Michael, adjuvant ribociclib, it's completed accrual and it says here the results are pending, but I'm pretty sure the results came out.
So, yeah, the primary results have come out. The three-year invasive disease-free survival, the combination of ribociclib, which is the agent under investigation in the NATALEE study, in addition to endocrine therapy versus endocrine therapy alone, significantly prolonging the invasive disease-free survival with a hazard ratio of 0.74. So, again, in the adjuvant setting, we're seeing a similar sort of thing, and we know that with the MONARCH-E study, that is showing some benefit as well, as per the updates that were released in last year's ESMO. And for full details on that, go back and listen to our ESMO episodes. They're much more focused than this current one. But we're seeing a similar sort of pattern emerge where palbociclib definitely works well in terms of preventing progressive disease recurrence, but for whatever reason, and I don't think we certainly don't have the answer, I don't think anyone else does, doesn't appear to be doing the necessary to convey an overall survival benefit.
Yeah, and I think if you actually look at the updated data for the MONARCH-E trial, it's also very interesting. They're up to about 4 years, but what they found is the invasive disease-free survival is 85.8% in the combination arm versus 79.4% in the standard of care arm with a statistical p-value and hazard ratio of 0.664. And interesting, that just continues to grow throughout the year. So there's actually a fair bit of interesting data there. But overall survival, again, at the point in time that this ASCO update, which was the 10th of October, overall survival is still immature.
Which, again, brings us to another issue with these studies is that it takes a long time for us to actually have overall survival data. Overall survival data is only mature when you have a certain number or a certain proportion of survival events, aka people passing away. And as we've mentioned before, aromatase inhibitors and endocrine therapy by itself is a very effective treatment, median overall survival of 51 months across several studies. But as a result, if you're trying to improve on that, it is going to take years and years and years before you have mature overall survival data, which is why there's been this sort of pregnant question almost just hanging in the air over the treatment of breast cancer. Is we have this in the early phase, we have the disease-free survival data. In the advanced stage, we have the progression-free survival data, but neither of these are surrogates for overall survival.
Yeah, I like to feel that it's a bit like a midnight London fog. We have these three great drugs and they all seem to be of benefit, but we're all chasing our tails, trying to find the light to see which one works the best.
Absolutely. And it is important, again, for us to say that we are focusing on the big trials. Mm. For example, the MONALEESA 7 study has had an exploratory analysis of patients that were specifically pre- or perimenopausal.
Mm-hmm.
We're assuming that the three pivotal trials are focusing on patients or the majority of women, just from a population perspective, are going to be postmenopausal with advanced breast cancer. But as an example, for MONALEESA 7, with 54 months of follow-up reported, the combination of ribociclib and endocrine therapy of some description demonstrated a significant improvement in overall survival with the addition of ribociclib. But we don't know if, for instance, palbociclib has a similar benefit in premenopausal women. I mean, there might have been subgroup analyses to that, but there haven't been sort of specific analyses for this group. My point is that we're casting a wide net, we're making sweeping general statements, but there are going to be segments of the population for whom one agent is better than the other.
That's it. And it also comes to toxicities and those sorts of things. And as another general statement, Michael, it also comes to the type of endocrine sensitivity and resistance. Right? It's something we don't truly understand in these cohorts of patients. As in Mona Lisa 2, 60% of the patients had a disease-free interval of longer than 2 years, suggesting endocrine-sensitive disease, whereas in Paloma 2, 40% had a disease-free interval of longer than 1 year, suggesting potentially a lower endocrine sensitivity. So there's all these nuances in the biology of this cancer that we as mere mortals, I'm a mere mortal, Michael's an Adonis of some variety, just don't
understand. We're both mere mortals, at least in the intellectual variety. But yes, and this is the paradox of oncology and I guess of science as a whole. We're talking about sweeping statements. You can't get much more sweeping than that. Yeah. Is that the more we know, the more we realize we don't know. So we know about this concept of endocrine resistance, and we know that we know some of the factors that go into it, but there's so much that we don't know.
Yes.
And the more complex a process, the more moving parts that are there, the greater possibility of heterogeneity, which means that there's no such thing as a one-size-fits-all treatment.
No. This is the whole argument with progressive cancer, that each tumor cell line and each clonal proliferation are going to be slightly different. I did want to maybe draw it to a sweeping conclusion.
Sweeping conclusion.
That is the word of this. So there has never been a proper head-to-head trial. I think that's it. There's the Harmonia. There's looking at those in the hormone receptor positive, HER2-enriched population. And that's palbociclib versus ribociclib. But again, not the main population we're talking about today. And so as a clinician, what do you do? The summary of this article is, if the person is receiving benefit on palbociclib, receiving benefit on abemaciclib, do not switch them, right? I've had patients, and I'm sure Michael has too, the person's 7 years plus and they're on palbociclib and they don't have a skerrick of disease. But if it's a new person and it's a new patient, they don't have cardiac problems or other contraindications, ribociclib, which is based on which trial?
The Mona Lisa 2 trial.
That's it. Good. We're listening.
We are listening.
The Mona Lisa 2 trial, that should be your first go-to line.
Yeah. And I guess the alternative, and this is actually, and you know, abemaciclib is actually gaining significant popularity, at least where we're working, because it's recently been approved as well. So the main toxicity with abemaciclib, the thing that it's notorious for, is gastrointestinal toxicity, diarrhea. And so if you have a patient who is able to tolerate diarrhea to some degree, not every patient with abemaciclib, of course, gets diarrhea, but if you have patients who can tolerate that, who aren't at risk of dehydration, kidney injury, non-compliance as a result, all of those sorts of things, treatment interruptions, then abemaciclib is also an option. But I guess the question is, what would you do if you had a patient with cardiac toxicity, previous arrhythmias, what have you, so you were a bit leery of ribociclib and you went through the toxicity of abemaciclib and they said, Josh, absolutely not. I guess the question there is, with the numbers that we have, do you give them palbociclib or do you just give them endocrine therapy alone? Because the evidence would suggest that you just give them endocrine therapy alone.
Yeah, I'm still not convinced with that. And I think with the loss to follow-up, a large number of people being lost to follow-up, not having a proper head-to-head comparison, and given my clinical experience, there are a large number of people that respond really well to palbociclib. And the comment here is that it's also very well-tolerated and probably the best-tolerated CDK inhibitor out of the three in the class, that I would give them the dual therapy, because there is going to be a subset that respond longer term, and that's what you want.
I would agree. And I think that your point about palbociclib being very, very well tolerated, it doesn't really have its signature toxicity, does it?
So rare for a drug not to have a signature toxicity in oncology.
Exactly. But palbociclib is one of those drugs where it doesn't really have a signature toxicity. There's nothing in particular that leaps to mind in the same way that cardiac toxicity does with ribociclib, as an example. So I think that there is honestly no right or wrong answer here. But what you're saying is completely right, in that we are talking about median overall survival.
Yep.
And so the nature of a median figure is that you're going to have people who do better than the average and people who do worse. And I think especially if you've got a younger patient or a fitter patient who for whatever reason can't either tolerate or has medical contraindications to one of the other agents, no one could fault you for giving palbociclib alone, aside from, you know, if there are any data warriors out there.
The data warriors are always out there, Michael.
But yes, and I do want to emphasize your point on a related point of the point that you made about not switching. Unlike with endocrine therapy, where there's evidence for switching between tamoxifen and AI in the adjuvant setting, there is no data that we're aware of about switching from one agent to another in terms of survival. Obviously, if there's tolerance issues, then you make the switch. But from a survival perspective, there's still no data. There's no head-to-head trials. And so if a patient is continuing to do well on palbociclib, keep them on palbociclib. Don't feel like you have to sort of uproot your entire practice for existing patients. In addition, and this is me going out on a bit of a limb here, but I would imagine that if the patient progresses on palbociclib, there's no point changing them to ribociclib in the same way that we would, for example, change letrozole to fulvestrant.
Yes, that's a really interesting question because I've actually sort of looked at that a little bit in the phase 2 MAINTAIN trial along with another trial, which I am blanking, the PACE 2 trial. And essentially there were contrasting results of looking at palbociclib and into fulvestrant post-progression of a previous CDK4/6. One said yes, there was benefit. One said no, there was not benefit.
Mm. So the jury is still out on that question. But it will be interesting to see the head-to-head trials because as these drugs come off patent,
that's going to happen.
Then they might happen as part of institution-led studies or retrospective studies, which would be the only way to put this question to bed once and for all. But Josh, last time you mentioned the future of this with novel agents.
I did. So what is the future for this? I think the next generation of CDK inhibitors is probably going to help sweep the world that is breast cancer. You know, the way it's working as such, they're looking at some new novel agents from other CDK inhibitions in tablet form. But even if that doesn't end up coming to fruition, most of the future line therapies are going to be based on genetic profiling. When I talk about that, I'm talking about ESR mutations. I'm talking about PIK3CA mutations. I'm talking about other such weird and wonderful mutations, which I haven't mentioned here. And these are all going to influence the treatment properly. And not everyone's going to have a mutation. And so what I mean by that is not everyone's going to have something that's targetable, but maybe it's also we don't have the technology yet to understand the targets and what we're approaching.
Yeah, it's going to be a very interesting few years, decades in this area because breast cancer probably remains one of the best treated cancers because it's very common. A lot of women have it. But it is going to be interesting to see how we can continue to eke out those last few percentage points.
That's it.
Novel agents increase focus on early molecular and genetic testing and as a consequence of that, having the agents with which to target what we find is going to be probably the next step.
That's it. I can't forget the ATM mutations, cabivacetin. Anyway, there's a ton of stuff out there. Michael, that was a great, great little convo between yours truly and Dr. Fernando. What are we doing next week?
So next week we're going to do what I believe is our first fireside chat episode for 2024.
And it's only April.
I'm sure our listeners will forgive our tardiness, but fireside chats, for those of you who haven't been with us too long, are episodes where Josh and I put a couple of logs on the fire, take out our corn cob pipe and chew the fat about something that doesn't involve hazard ratios and p-values. And so next week we're going to be talking about a topic that has gained a lot of traction in popular news media recently, and that is the increasing prevalence of cancer, particularly colorectal cancer, in younger people. It is a very important topic and one that some of our listeners might be worried professionally or personally about. We will have all of that along with the accompanying New York Times article next week. So we'll see you then.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Oncology for the Inquisitive Mind. If you like this episode, there's plenty more where that came from. Check out our website, inquisitiveonc.com, that's inquisitiveonc.com, for links to all of our previous episodes. You'll find links to our social media there as well. If you'd like a particular subject covered on the show, feel free to drop us a line on Twitter at inquisitiveonc or via email at inquisitiveonc@gmail.com. This has been Oncology for the Inquisitive Mind, a podcast by ADC Productions.